श्रीमद्भागवतं की जय। कौवे प्रभानन्दे ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। So today's verse, Canto 12, Chapter 2, Text 4. Ningam eva samakyavat अन्योन्यापत्तिकारणम् अवृत्त्यान्यायदौर्बल्यम् पाण्डित्ये चापदं वचः लिङ्गमेवाश्रमख्याता अन्योन्यापत्तिकारणम् अवृत्त्यान्यायदौर्बल्यम् पाण्डित्ये चापदं वचः।
Would someone mind reading the word for word in the translation and purport for me? I'm still struggling with my voice.
The eternal symbol. External. Eva. Merely. Ashrama. Krityatau. In knowing a person's spiritual order. Anyonya, mutual. Apati, of exchange. Karanam, the cause. Avritya, being without money. Nyaya, justice. Daurbalyam, inability. Panditye, in scholarship. Kapalam, tricky. Vachaha. Words. A person's spiritual order will be ascertained merely according to external symbols, and on the same basis, people will change from one spiritual order to the next. One who has no money will be unable to get justice, and one who is very clever at juggling words will be considered a learned scholar. Report. The previous verse stated that in the age of Kali, the priestly class will be recognized by external symbols alone, and this verse extends the same principle to the spiritual orders of society, namely the students, householders, retirees, and renunciates. One casualty of the age of Kali is an impartial judicial system, and thus, today, the poor often find themselves victimized by a system rife with high-priced lawyers and corrupt judges. Intellectuality is another casualty of the bewildering age of Kali. Modern so-called philosophers and scientists have created a technical, esoteric terminology for each branch of learning. And when they give lectures, people consider them learned simply because of their ability to speak that which no one else can understand. In Western culture, the Greek sophists, were among the first to systematically argue for rhetoric and quote-unquote efficiency above wisdom and purity. And sophistry certainly flourishes in the 20th century. Modern universities have very little wisdom, though they do possess a virtual infinity of technical data. Although many modern thinkers are fundamentally ignorant of the higher spiritual reality, they are, so to speak, quote-unquote, good talkers. And most people simply don't take notice. Don't notice their ignorance.
A person's spiritual position will be ascertained merely according to external symbols. And on the same basis, a person's proprietor will be seriously questioned if he does not earn a good living, and one who is very clever at juggling words will be considered a learned scholar. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he explains that the 10th and 11th canto immerses the hearer, the listener, in the ecstasy of the pastimes and the message of Krishna, Bhagavan. And the purpose of the 12th canto is detachment from everything else, except for Krishna. And we are in the beginning of the 12th canto, right after the disappearance of Krishna. And the disappearance of Krishna, of course, pastime-wise, is very significant, it's very profound. But it's also profound in the context of the Bhagavatam, because his disappearance and his pastime also marks the philosophical demarcation between the what our goal and what our aim, what the object of our love is, and what it is not. So our acharyas explain that equally are important. We need to know what we want and what we don't want. And the reason why is because it gives emphasis to what we want. When we understand what we don't want or what's not good for us, it further we have a stronger conviction, stronger desire for what is good for us, what is beneficial for us. Our acharyas explain unanimously that the age of Kali, it began the moment Krishna left. Literally, the moment Krishna left, Kali Yuga began. It's interesting because a lot of the common opinion, and this is why Srila Prabhupada was so heavily speaking against the professional Bhagavatam reciters, is that these professional Bhagavat Katha, in many of the circles, Bhagavat Katha circles, they claim that Kali Yuga began when Parikshit Maharaj garlanded Samaki Rishi with a snake. And that is when the age of Kali entered into Kali Yuga. Now for devotees, when we hear something like that, it's detestable. Like, we can't even conceive how can anyone can say that. Yet that's the popular opinion. The Aprasasampradaya. Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he identified 13 Aprasampradayas. And when we receive knowledge, that's not coming from the genuine source, from devotees, unadulterated devotees, then we can easily get it. Because on the surface, externally, yeah, why not? You know, makes sense. He took a snake and garlanded it in Shamukha Rishi, which clearly, you know, etiquette-wise, is inappropriate. But if you read the commentaries of all of our acharyas, Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, Jiva Goswami, Goswamis, Srila Prabhupada, Bhaktisiddhanta Goswami, it's unanimously said that Parikshit Maharaj was under the sway of Yoga Maya, that this is Krishna's pastime. He inspired Parikshit Maharaj to do this. And it's interesting that it's so easy to disprove this fallacy. Because if that's the case, just prior to that, before this incident, prior to that, Parikshit Maharaj was chastising Kali. Remember the bull? And he had only one leg left. And he basically gave him an allowance of how, you know, of where and how he can reside in this world. So how is it possible that Kali entered when this happened prior to Parikshit Maharaj garlanding Samaki Rishi with the snake? And actually, are the commentators and the acharyas make the point that it's actually Sringi, the son of Samaki Rishi, who cursed Parikshit Maharaj. It was that act which caused the downfall of the entire Brahmanic class of people. And at that point in time, from that point in time onwards, there would be no Brahmanas left anymore. No genuine Brahmanas. Because generally, when you're born in a Brahmana family, traditionally, you have the Brahminical nature. But from that point on, that rule is set aside. It's based only on quality. I was reading yesterday. Krishna's disappearance is a very dramatic. I mean, you couldn't even the greatest creative writers in the world could never have come up with a more dramatic story than the disappearance of Krishna. If you read the details, you're just struck with wonder. Like, it's so, like, incredible. It's just so dynamic, colorful, and, like, counterintuitive, and contradictory, and full of energy, and rasa, and mystery, and confusion, all at the same time. I was reading how when the Yadavas were fighting each other, they were on the backs of all these different animals, elephants and camels, and they were explaining how the Yadavas were on the backs of each other, fighting each other, and then just the intensity and the massacre and how, you know, they killed it with bamboo reeds. It's unbelievable. And then after they're all devastated, it's explained that Krishna, he was about to leave, and his chariot and the horses just elevated into the air, and Daruka came, and Krishna instructed him to go inform the residents of Dwarka what happened, and then Krishna's weapons went up in the air, and then he left. And after Daruka went back to Dwarka and informed everyone, the description is just unbelievable. You know, Vasudev and Devaki, they just immediately on the spot passed away. They just left their bodies, so to speak. And the wives of the others, they immediately entered into the fire. And Krishna's daughter-in-laws, they all also went into the fire. So it was like, you know, all the men died, and then all the ladies died. It's just inconceivable. Inconceivable. And then Vishnu, after this whole elaborate description, of course I'm not giving it justice, but he gives such incredible detail of this incredibly dramatic winding up of Krishna's pastimes. He gives the analogy that, and I've heard the story told in two different ways, but it's a pastime of the magician. And I'm sure some of you have heard it. But there was a magician who came to the I'll actually retell the story from what I heard, my Guru Maharaj, the way he said it. But Vishnathakurvita Thakur, he explains the story slightly different. So the magician comes into the assembly of the king in the courtroom. And and the king presented all of these valuable items, gold and jewelry and saris and silk, and all types of valuable ornaments. And the magician said, okay, I'm going to take this, I'm going to take that. He just basically took everything. And in my understanding, it wasn't meant all for the magician. But he said, I'm going to take this, I'm going to take that, I'm going to take this. He just kept on saying, I'm going to take everything. And the family members of the king got so upset, and they started killing each other somehow. They started killing each other. And then the family, the relatives of the magician, they started killing each other. They all died. Actually, just before that, the magician, he sat down in samadhi, and he was doing dhyana and yoga and all these different things, and he self-immolated, and his whole body, you know, turned into fire. And then his family members all committed suicide or killed each other. And the king was just watching this whole thing, just like, what in the world has just happened? And a few days later, 3 or 4 days later, the magician wrote a letter to the king, said, how did you like the magic show? And the king is like, the magic show? He's like, yeah, all of your relatives are fine, all my relatives are fine, everyone's fine. And you know, if you're impressed, to whatever degree you're impressed, you can give me a donation. So in the same way, Vishnathakurvita Thakur explains, is this whole winding up of Krishna's Leela is like this magic show. It's true to those who perceive it to be true, and that, but those who really know, it was all of his lila. So, in the 12th canto I was reading yesterday, in the second chapter, he reminded me of how actually the Western Indologists, they act. This is one of the things they actually agree, is that there are kings in the lineage here that the Indologists actually recognize and say there's actually historical proof that these kings actually lived and they actually existed. Archaeologically, sociologically, historically, they existed. But the Indologists, they say that, but it's impossible that the Bhagavatam is predictive, because that's in the realm of miraculous. When there's no such thing as miracles, everything is mechanistic. So how is it possible that the Bhagavatam was written before these kings appeared? It's not possible. So the Indologists, they did two things. One type of scholars, they said that, well, that must mean the Bhagavatam must have been written or compiled or whatever after the fact, you know, after the kings appeared. And then another group of scholars, their theory is the theory of interpolation. Interpolation is, okay, it may have been written 5,000 years ago, but over the period of time, the different, you know, periods of time, things were interpolated, inserted into the Bhagavatam to make it seem greater than it really is. You know, the Bhagavatam isn't like predictive. It isn't, you know, it isn't transcendent. It's just a mundane literature that's made by humans. So these are the two things. But interpolation is not a new thing. I remember many years ago when the first time I read the Tattva Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami, he spoke about interpolation. And interpolation was actually nothing new, because even in India, the scholars in the different sampradayas were claiming that different scriptures were interpolated. Even the Brahma Sampradaya, and within the Brahma Sampradaya, Jiva Goswami, he explains this, that there are certain members of the Brahma Sampradaya that were so offended by the Brahma Vimohan Lila that they said that that was interpolated in the Bhagavatam, that it actually is not part of the genuine Bhagavatam. It was inserted in there to denigrate the Brahma Sampradaya. Brahma Vimohan Lila is when he was questioning the identity of Krishna Bhagavan. So he stole the cowherd boys and the cow and the calves, in that famous pastime. And then, of course, Krishna expanded himself as all the cowherd boys in pastime. So you always have two classes of people. You have the mechanistic scholars, and then you also have the devotional scholars on the path of bhakti. And I was also thinking this morning how the descriptions that you hear of in Kali Yuga of just the symptoms, you know, how the hairstyle, and you've been reading the last few weeks, it's incredible how this could have been predicted, because Srila Prabhupada, and we know in the time of Mahatma Gandhi and before, that's just 100 years ago. Can you imagine what society was like a few hundred years ago? They could never imagine any of this. If you had read this to somebody from Srila Prabhupada's time, they wouldn't believe it. So if you don't believe, if you don't accept the lineage of the kings, then the description of the symptoms of the age of Kali is also very convincing that this is a transcendent literature. So the point before this verse, or actually, I think it was a few verses before, and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur talks about this, that previously, in Varnashram Dharma, there's Dhamma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, and everything was done according to Varnashram Dharma. And we know that Paradharma, which is the fifth dharma, is bhakti. But in Varnashram, there's the four goals of life. But in civilized society, everything was considered within these four arthas. But it's explained how in Kali, that money is considered, replaces all other considerations. Like, for instance, I was thinking, even the time of Lord Ramachandra. So Ramachandra, when he was banished to the forest, if that happened in today's day and age, a prince was banished to the forest, and he was penniless, he didn't have a penny to his name, he just considered a reject, right? Just be considered a reject. No one would care about his lineage. Lineage? What's the lineage? Okay, he's broke. He's homeless. You know, he used to be part of this lineage or whatever, but he's broke now. He's homeless. But that wasn't always the case. Each one of these factors were considered separately. So lineage remained intact regardless of how much money you had. There's so much emphasis, the Moon Dynasty, the Sun Dynasty. So when Ram was banished and was a homeless beggar, a penniless, he was respected everywhere he went in civilized society because of the dynasty. That was never taken away from him. And the other opulences, like it's explained, I should pull up a verse here, but if someone in this today's day and age, if you're a billionaire, and you behave in a certain way, because you're a billionaire, that behavior is accepted as truth. That behavior must be correct because this billionaire is doing it. Or if a billionaire is proud and arrogant and is rough with his people, because he's a billionaire, makes those qualities desirable. So money replaces lineage. Money replaces good character. Money is the determining factor for everything in the age of Kali. And that was the point that Sukadeva Goswami made just a few verses ago. So now the current verse, we're reading today, it's similar. But the point that is being made here is that, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about this extensively in his monumental work, Jiva Dharma. And it is, and he talks about this all throughout the whole book. I don't know if any of you have written it or read it, but it's been translated by Srila Prabhupada's disciples. In Srila Prabhupada actually speaks about Jiva Dharma. And how it's one of the greatest literary, contributions Bhaktivinoda Thakur gave to the world. Is this concept of bahirmukha and antarmukha, external versus internal. And in Kali Yuga, the judgment is based on externalities. And in Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he strings this theme along throughout the entire book of how of every aspect of Krishna consciousness can be categorized in these two different ways, antarmukha and bahirmukha. Someone who is externally oriented, someone who's internally oriented. Someone who's externally oriented, someone who's internally oriented. And the way he presents these truths, the Jiva Dharma, the reason why it's so brilliant, you know, beyond, like light years beyond the greatest literary achievements in the Western world, Shakespeare times a million, is because the presentation of bhakti and Jaiva Dharma was done in so many different dimensions. It wasn't just theoretical. It wasn't just factual. It wasn't just a list of facts. It was a description of how knowledge was passed on from the teacher to the disciple. How they spoke to each other. How they behaved. How that knowledge was imparted. The behavior when there was knowledge that wasn't consistent. So it was not, and the teachings were there too in the conversations. But it was the example of how of the people that practiced those and what happened to them after they practiced it. So it's a story of the person's lives and the teacher and the teachings of those particular people. So it's so brilliant. By the time you end up reading it, you're like, wow, it's not just the knowledge that they're communicating to me. It's the story of these people's lives. It's the example. It was from all these different dimensions. It's almost like Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He gave you an experience of what bhakti is just by reading the book. Like for instance, you can tell someone that bhakti is devotion to God. Right? So that's a statement. That's a piece of knowledge. But if I write a whole novel, which Jaiva Dharma is essentially, it's a novel, it's a story, that talks about people who talk about saying that bhakti and what it means to them and what happened to them, it's an entirely different experience. When you're reading something theoretical about bhakti versus when you're reading a book like Jaiva Dharma, you're actually experiencing what bhakti is. You're actually experiencing it, not just intellectually theorizing what it is. So he talks about this principle of external and internal. And essentially, the point that he's making is that you can't judge based on the external. And I was also reading recently the biography of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and also I maybe think of a few examples from the Bhagavatam. This one story I read just a few days ago was it was a band of thieves that entered the Gaudiya Math, and they stole a bag of mangoes. And the disciple and the members of the Gaudiya Math, they captured him, they tied him up, and they put him away. And the next morning, when Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he gave his darshan, they brought him to Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj and said, "We found, you know, this group of bandits, and they stole mangoes." And Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj was very upset. He said that everything in the Gaudiya Math is prasad, and therefore everything in the storeroom was also prasad. So he made them let them go, and then he sent that disciple who tied them up. He sent them bags and bags of mangoes to the village where they came from. But then there was another incident where somebody stole coconuts in the Gaudiya Math, and can you hear me? Someone stole coconuts. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur took it so seriously that he actually went to court. And he was a witness saying he stole from Bhagavan. Externally, it's exactly the same thing. But in one, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he brought bags and bags and bags of mangoes to the village, let them go, and said, "How could you even do this?" And then another person, he's testifying in court that he stole from Bhagavan. So the life of the acharya is inconceivable. We cannot make determinations externally. I was thinking, I was listening to a lecture by my Guru Maharaj, and he was talking about the story of Devahuti and Kardama Muni. And from all material standards, Kardama Muni was living in a cave and didn't have a penny to his name. He didn't have a home. And yet, Swayambhuva Manu and Devahuti came, you know, in the swan. And came down, and they paid obeisances to Kardama Muni. He took the dust from his lotus feet, and they begged him to accept their daughter, and explained that Devahuti was so beautiful that denizens of the heavenly planets would fall unconscious and fall from the airplanes and just flying over the rooftop of Kardama Muni when they saw Devahuti. So what were they seeing in Kardama Muni? They were seeing his quality, his character. And and then the other story, just the story I was mentioning before, of Vishwamitra asking for Lord Ram. And how much command, you know, Vishwamitra had, that he could take the prince, you know, Lakshman, Ram, to kill the demons. And I was thinking of Pastimes of Srila Prabhupada, because I've been watching the following Srila Prabhupada series, and there's pastimes similar to that. In Srila Prabhupada's life. And this one story I mentioned before of how Srila Prabhupada's disciples invited a scholar. And all of his students, they came. And the scholar was saying that amongst the acharyas there are so many contradictions. And Srila Prabhupada said, amongst the acharyas there are no contradictions. I don't know if anyone can impersonate Prabhupada, but you know, you can imagine amongst the acharyas there are no contradictions, you know. You just basically shut them up. Just like that. And he said, why are you cheating? After like 2 minutes of silence, he said, why are you cheating your students? You're a cheater. He said, haven't you read the Vedas? And it says, the first, before knowledge, you can acquire any knowledge you need to surrender to a spiritual master. Do you have a guru? And he said, no, I don't have a guru. So then you're a cheater. And then he actually requested one of his disciples to carry him out, you know, saying, Prabhupada, he's like, get him out of here, you know. So they actually took the scholar out of the room in front of all of his disciples. It totally humiliated him. So Srila Prabhupada didn't have very much. He was impressed by his scholarship at all. You know, and he was supposedly the greatest Sanskrit scholar in the world. He was considered the greatest Sanskrit scholar. And his PhD thesis was the works of the Goswamis. The works of the Goswamis. And he's saying amongst the acharyas. And there was another pastime. Oh. That's actually not a pastime. I was mentioning earlier about the Bhagavad reciters, and I don't know if you searched in the database what Srila Prabhupada had to say about the Bhagavatam reciters, professional reciters. He was not very impressed by them either. He preached very strongly against professional Bhagavatam reciters. And this is a really important lesson, because I was thinking about this actually last week. The goal of speaking or giving katha or doing a class or facilitating Bhagavatam class isn't to entertain the audience. That's not the purpose. I was actually watching and following Srila Prabhupada. I was watching some footage, and Srila Prabhupada was giving a lecture, and he started panning across the audience. And some people were like, you know, falling asleep. And if Srila Prabhupada was, you know, like an entertainer or who's doing a stand-up comedy routine or whatever, they probably wouldn't be sleeping. But was Prabhupada trying to entertain the audience? Because what is entertainment? And entertainment is some momentary fleeting kind of sensual high where you kind of like, you know, you kind of like getting some kind of, you know, buzz, you know, from it. But Srila Prabhupada, his charisma isn't what, you know, made people give up their lives to follow him. His hand movements didn't, you know, his incredible storytelling ability, you know, didn't convince people to surrender their lives to Srila Prabhupada. What was it that Srila Prabhupada gave? He wasn't a charismatic speaker, perhaps, to some people. What was it that made people give their lives? Because Srila Prabhupada, it was his, we already know, his compassion. You know, people, when they heard Srila Prabhupada, they felt that it was his purity, his desire to uplift the people he was speaking to, regardless of how he was able to speak, and how his storytelling abilities are, and how his hand movements are, and all these different public speaking techniques. These are all external. I remember when I was little, Varshana Maharaj used to come to DC often, and he would speak these pastimes of Lord Chaitanya and Nimai. And I was maybe a teenager at the time. And I would just, and he would speak for hours. I remember for 3 hours, he would just speak hours and hours and hours of this katha. And I would just sit there listening. And he conquered my heart. And I remember praying that Krishna, if you so desire, please let him ask my parents for me. Because I just want him to take me. And just own me, and just take me wherever he goes. I was praying like that every day. I was like, just please inspire Varshana Maharaj to tell my parents that I want your son. Because I had a feeling my dad would give me away to him. Like, just give me away to this person. I just wanted to be given away to Varshana Maharaj. It wasn't Varshana Maharaj's charisma. It wasn't his hand movements. It was his prema bhakti. He was swimming in the ocean of love of God in his heart. That convinced me that I wanted to give my life to this person. And the disciples of Srila Prabhupada had the same experience with Srila Prabhupada. I was thinking of some examples of how Srila Prabhupada externally, the converse of it is also true. Externally, like, people may have no good qualities, no good assets. Like the first disciples of Srila Prabhupada were from the Bowery, and they were drug addicts, and they had no money, and they had no position, they had no prestige, they had no fame, and yet Srila Prabhupada gave his life for these people. So the converse of it is true. So the people with extreme, material opulences, he rejected and criticized. And then also there are individuals like George Harrison who had incredible wealth, incredible fame. Yet Srila Prabhupada treated him like his son. He showered him with love and affection. So you have people with material assets that Prabhupada disregarded, people with material assets that Prabhupada highly regarded, and people that were poor and derelict that Prabhupada disregarded. So the lesson is that the external characteristics of an individual is never taken into consideration. It's never a replacement of their internal bhav, their internal quality, their internal sincerity, their internal qualities. And that is the real qualification for bhakti. And in our Saturday satsanga recently, we were discussing how the lesson, because we hear that it's so important. We hear things in Shastra that who is a Vaishnava? You know, someone who chants the holy name of Krishna once is a Vaishnava, right? And then we it's told that we have to associate with devotees. We have to associate with devotees. So then at the same time, we can't judge anyone, but at the same time, we're told to judge everyone. So our acharyas, we're talking, our acharyas explain that what does it mean to judge? Just judging means to discriminate. And we discriminate on the basis of the activity. That if you're with somebody who's a drunkard, he breaks the four regulative principles every day, and he's in the temple room, jumping up and down, chanting Harinam Sankirtan, and you're dancing with him in the temple room, Harinam Sankirtan, that is devotee association. Yet, if you are with a Tridandi Sannyasi who's followed the four regulative principles in his entire life, who's read the Bhagavatam 100 times, and you go with that person to the movies to watch some sense gratificatory movie, that is not devotee association. So it's not necessarily, the discrimination is not the basis, it's not on the basis of the person. We never judge the person. We judge the activity, only the activity. So we always want to engage in devotional service. And whoever is engaging in devotional service, that's who we want to associate with at that time. I've heard my Guru Maharaj say that somebody did incredible service for Srila Prabhupada, but then they fell down. So when they're doing incredible service for Srila Prabhupada, and they give their life for Srila Prabhupada, and you're with them, you're associating with devotees. And when he fell down, and when he was, you know, doing so many nonsense things, you're not associating with him. But that doesn't negate that previously, in that previous time, when he was engaged in 100% pure devotional service, that was a devotee association. And you benefited from that association. So, that's a very important lesson. Because that's been a question raised over the years so many times. I've heard that we have to judge who's a devotee, who's not a devotee. But actually, it's more important to judge what we're doing and how we're being engaged in Krishna service, and engaging that service with other individuals who are doing the same. Thank you. Would anyone like to make any comments? Questions? Oh, yeah, there's Mataji is raising her hand. Yeah. Oh, I just wanted to, before we go into question, I just wanted, Pani Bhushan Prabhu, I don't know if you remember, you told me. This is actually a perfect example. Long time ago, Pani Bhushan Prabhu told me that Lord Chaitanya, during Chaturmasya, he was traveling to South India. He stayed with the illiterate Brahmana. You know the story of the illiterate Brahmana. He's reading the Bhagavad Gita upside down, and he was saying all the words incorrectly. But Lord Chaitanya, remember you told me this? Lord Chaitanya stayed with this illiterate Brahmana for 4 months. And Pani Bhushan Prabhu made the point that Krishna, he was such a non-person. In other words, he was a totally not, like, unknown in society. That Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami in the Chaitanya Charitamrita doesn't even mention his name in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Yet, Lord Chaitanya spent 4 months with him. So this goes to the point. Anyways, the point is, it was such a significant, you know, person that Lord Chaitanya, you know, spent time with him. But his name wasn't mentioned, you know. Yeah, so he may not have stayed 4 months. But the point that I'm trying to make is that Lord Chaitanya didn't judge him on his external, you know, scholarship or his you know, or the Brahmin and the cobbler, that story. Of, you know, the Brahmana was going to stay for millions and millions of births, you know, Hari said, but the cobbler is going back at the end of this life. So the external characteristics of the individual is never, you know, taken, given higher importance than the internal bhav, because Lord Chaitanya asked, what is making you, you know, cry in ecstasy? Is this just thinking of my Bhagavan Sri Krishna? He's a charioteer driver. And someone was mentioning to me, just imagine Lord Krishna being a taxi driver in Manhattan. Right, that's basically, you know, because the taxi, the chariot is the taxi of that age. There was no taxi drivers. Everything was chariots. But I mean, you know, but he was thinking of Krishna, you know, just being the charioteer driver for Arjuna, his devotee. And his tears were coming down his eyes, and so much love, you know. How wonderful is my Krishna, that he's taking such a subordinate position to Krishna. The mic is here, sorry. So Pani Bhushan Prabhu was making the point that what was conquering his heart was a relationship between the devotee and Krishna, and how Krishna took a subordinate position, how he was conquered by his bhakti, by his love. He was conquered by that love.
That's the internal abundance.
And that's the internal abundance.
Not the external friendship, but the internal action. Mm.
Internal action based on the friendship.
That's why
Pani Bhushan Prabhu was my mentor for many years. When I was growing up, he was like my guru. He taught me so many things. And he actually stayed at our house for a few months, and he was my siksha guru for many years. Thank you, Pani Bhushan Prabhu.
We were producing that as a play.
Yeah. Mataji.
What an enlightening class. Such a pleasure. So many points that you brought up, and I was just going to mention a few of them, but also it gave me such faith that this movement will continue, because there's such a wealth of information about Prabhupada, you know, conversations, and just to hear that you're taking advantage of it and really studying it was really wonderful. Thank you for that.
Thank you for your encouragement, Mataji.
I was going to mention, like with the story about the mango, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta sent the mangoes to the village, the people who stole them, and then took the coconut people to court. So is that because Bhaktisiddhanta just understood the mentality of those people and was trying to correct a deviant mentality?
That seems to make sense to me. Otherwise, yeah. I mean, I don't think when I read that in the anecdotes, it didn't explain. And I don't think Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj explained himself. But you know, it seems that in the story we were talking about in the previous class of how Haridas Thakur in the Harinam Sankirtan, he would like have symptoms of ecstasy, and the snake charmer. You know, that famous story, he was, you know, he was in so much ecstasy, he was glorifying Haridas Thakur. And then somebody else wanted to imitate Haridas Thakur, and he was like dancing in ecstasy, and he's rolling on the ground, and the snake charmer started beating him. And he says, why didn't you beat Haridas Thakur? He did the same exact thing. So externally, it was the same exact thing. He was rolling on the ground, tears, hair standing on end, you know, in ecstasy. And yet, one person, the stick charmer, was beating with the stick, and another person, he was glorifying, and was, you know, exalting. Mm-hmm. So Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, in the same way, externally, you know, one person he chastised. And so it's the mentality of the. I would agree with you, Mataji.
And when you were speaking about how in the beginning of Kali Yuga, and how the differences, you know, in the. The line, you know, it's like what I was really appreciating how important it is that you hear from the pure devotee, because even recently, not kind of recently, someone was giving class and they were mentioning that Yudhisthira, when he lied, that's why he touched the ground. But that's not what Srila Prabhupada said. Srila Prabhupada said the reason Yudhisthira touched the ground is because he hesitated when he said the elephant, Ashwatthama.
Wow.
Is dead, you know what I mean? So it's
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
We're so fortunate to be able to hear from the pure devotee to really internalize that. And
it's not because he lied, it's because he hesitated to lie.
that's what Prabhupada said, yeah, because Krishna gave him that order. Yeah. So everything that we do is not necessarily based on, you know, mundane morality. It's based on what Krishna said. Anyway, I feel very excited to read Jiva Dharma now. I didn't really know much about it. So thank you for such a wonderful class.
Oh, thank you, Mataji.
Speaking of Jiva Dharma, you said, who translated it?
So Sarvabhavana Prabhu translated it, but it's been translated by several of Prabhupada's disciples. There have been different translations, but Sarvabhavana Prabhu translated.
Which one would you recommend?
Banu Maharaj is, you know, an editor for many of these. But Sarvabhavana Prabhu, his English, the Jiva Dharma, you know, sometimes when you read translations of our acharyas or literature, they're sometimes kind of substandard English. But Sarvabhavana Prabhu, his English is just top class English, just very, very beautiful, you know, English literature, the way he translated it. Yeah, Pushakrata Prabhu, he's translated many of the same books.
Remember, I mean, you were saying about so easy to defeat the aspect, you know, about some people say that Kali Yuga started, you know, when Maharaj Pariksit put the snake. And that's so crazy because before that, like you said, Kali came.
I remember a lecture by Ramapan Maharaj, and this is where I heard it. And he was talking about this, he heard this from a Bhagavad reciter, and he said, that's nonsense! He was like yelling at the whole crowd, like, this is nonsense! You know? I was like, and when he said it, I was just like, it really penetrated my heart, this is nonsense, you know, that Pariksit Maharaj, you know.
It definitely comes from mundane morality, or, you know, like Yudhisthira Maharaj telling a lot, you know, and that's where the Indian mentality goes.
Speculation, mental speculation.
Morality, you know, based on all morality. And but it's so strange that they would say about Kali coming there when Kali came there before. And Maharaj books. It's like. And the other thing I was thinking about predictions, you know, that describes in the Bhagavatam, and they say, well, it's just added later on or whatever. But then how do they justify their thoughts when we have such predictions, you know, like we're mentioning that are here right now? How do they refute that, or what do they have to say about Kalki coming, and is it that when Kalki comes then they're going to say, oh, this is, you know, put afterwards, or, you know?
So I've actually studied, like, just I've kind of observed the behavior of these scholars. You know, just for many, many years, I've observed this. You know, it's just over and over and over and over again. I've observed this over and over again. And Jhutakarma Prabhu, he speaks about this in Forbidden Archaeology. And, you know, in Sadaputta Prabhu, they talk about this, you know, constantly. But this is the standard response is that they're just stupid, you know. They just kind of vilify them. It's like, how can you be so stupid? That's kind of like their attitude. Like, for instance, if I say I don't believe in evolution, right? That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. How could you not believe in evolution? So what they do is they just talk down on you, and they don't use logic, they don't use reasoning. They're just like, everybody believes in evolution. How could you not believe in evolution? You're stupid, you know? So that's kind of like the attitude, you know, the scholarly attitude, is they always talk down.
And I've seen this over and over and over and over and over again, you know, just all these different types of, you know, things that come up. They do this tactic of just talking down on you without engaging in an actual conversation and in using argument and logic and proof. Yeah.
You know, they said that they made them feel that what they have, the culture they have, is low. It's,
yeah.
Or everything is mythology, or, but the idea is to make them feel,
yeah,
it's just all low class.
And when you repeat it enough times, and you indoctrinate it, and you have enough marketing, enough television airing program, and enough internet, whatever, you end up convincing lots of ignorant people about something that's not true. And then they use that as a proof that millions of people, billions of people believe in evolution. How can you not? As opposed to actually looking at the facts and examining the logic. You know, there's one, it's such an easy proof. It's called, if you read the scientists, these are biochemists and like highly scholarly people. That there's a famous book called The Black Box that was written. And it's such a powerful, you know, proof that evolution cannot have happened. Is called the irreducible complexity logical hypothesis, where like the eye is impossible. Like, for instance, the Darwinian evolution is when you have a series of sequential events that in these slight changes, you know, end up creating life. But there are certain parts of the body, or actually all parts of the body, whereas one change wouldn't make sense unless the entire organ is considered holistically. So in other words, it doesn't make sense for evolution to produce an optic nerve if there's no eye. It doesn't make sense for evolution to produce a cornea or an iris or a lens or an eyelid or eyelashes unless there's an eye. So there has to have been a designer that took the overall design of the eye and actually created it. Because why would evolution create an optic nerve, right? If there's no eye, right? So that's the irreducible complexity, which is talked about. That's just one of the many, you know, logical proofs that, you know, evolutionists don't, you know.
Come back to Mother Sukada's comments with Maharaj Yudhisthira. Even though you kind of hinted, but I thought it's not clear enough, so I just want to comment on that, make it clear that Maharaj Yudhisthira didn't, you know, it wasn't because he hesitated to tell a lie, but it's because he hesitated to follow Krishna's instruction. I just want to make that clear. That was the point.
Exactly. That's so exactly that. The highest morality is sarvadharma pratyecha mamekam.
Execute the Lord's instruction.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Unlike Arjuna, who didn't hesitate.
Exactly.
That was
Thank you, Prabhu. That's very important. Yeah, clarification.
All right, I'm going to be complicated and difficult. But one thing is, all these debates about who's right and who's wrong have always been going on. It didn't start with Kali Yuga. You know, I'm looking at the next chapter summary. It says, of course, in Satya Yuga, mode of goodness and religion is in full blossom, but Treta Yuga is predominated by passion and dwarf. Do I get it right? Dwarpa Yuga is passion, Treta Yuga, passion and ignorance, Kali Yuga, ignorance. So it's not like everything's a hop. It's not like suddenly Kali Yuga is like we go up the cliff and everything was happy before this. You know, there's difficulties, there's debates, each school of thought thinks they got it right, and they have some lame excuse why the other schools of thought missed the point. So there's nothing new about this. I got to say something about evolutionary theory. You know, there's one argument, irreducible complexity. It has its strength, it has its weaknesses. It's not a new argument. You know, the Black Box book, it has its own critics. And I think if you go out there talking like this, that somehow that disproves evolutionary theory, it doesn't hold much weight. It's an argument. It's something that's been debated in different forms and contexts for hundreds of years. You know,
why doesn't it hold much weight?
Because it's in the realm of punditry.
Use logic.
I'm about to.
Okay.
In the realm of punditry, there's always argument and counter-argument. It's endless. It's endless. And science itself, the ideals is, we have so much evidence available to us, and this that seems credible, and here's a hypothesis that seems to provide an explanation. It's all tentative.
Yeah, but what specific logic can you use to defeat irreducible complexity?
Irreducible complexity from a scientific perspective just means a research challenge. We don't have a natural explanation to explain this, but we don't have all the evidence yet in. There's always a possibility for a better explanatory hypothesis.
You know,
from a scientific perspective, irreducible complexity is a cop-out. It just means you don't have a scientific explanation.
Yeah, and also from the Vedic perspective, it's spiritual. You know, so it's the evolution of consciousness which attracts the material body.
Of course.
So
of
if
course.
You have motive ignorance or motive passion, then it attracts that kind of body to.
Yeah, well, spiritual evolution is a whole other dynamic beyond science, professional science.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're talking about professional science and its standards, irreducible complexity doesn't hold much weight. Mm-hmm. I mean, it may hold more weight philosophically or theologically, but not as a professional argument for professional scientists.
That's actually a good point, that, you know, the path of bhakti isn't about arguing forever.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the larger point is that.
But, yeah, it's achintya, you know, bhakti is achintya, it's inconceivable. So it's getting late, and I have to work, unfortunately. Grantrad Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Shri Prabhupada ki jai. Pani Bhushan Prabhu ki.